It is Perek Beis, Mishnah Gimel 2, 3, and we continue on with the testimonies of Rabbi Chanina Skana Kohanim. He has two different points to make here in this Mishnah. The first one is about the following. When you have a loan contract, or any contract for that matter, so who would you expect to write it? So the basic premise of the Mishnah, like going into things, is that the normal person to write it should be the borrower, not the lender, because the lender sort of, he's like got a vested interest, and if I whip out a piece of paper that says, look, here, in my own handwriting, it says you owe me money. That seems a little dubious. So it would be normal for the borrower to be the one to write the IOU. But the basic point of our mission here is that it doesn't matter who writes the contract. This part doesn't seem so surprising to us in the modern age, because what makes the contract effective isn't the handwriting by which it was written, but rather the witnesses which effectuate the contract. That makes it empowered, because they're certifying the contract is true, that it happened, and therefore we don't care who writes the contract. That's the gist of our Mishnah. The words inside have a little more color. They say, Afhu he'id al, he also testified regarding the following. Al kfar katon shahaya b'tzad Yerushalayim. There was this little village that was just adjacent to Jerusalem. V'haya vo zakin echad. There was one chacham over there, some rabbi. V'haya malve l'chol b'nei hakfar. He would be like the source of funding to lend to all the different villagers there. V'kosav b'chsav yado, he would write the IOU contracts himself in his own hand. V'achirim chosman, and then he would get other people, you know, two kosher witnesses to certify by signing on the contract to enforce, to certify the contract was legitimate. And that was queried, is that appropriate? Why isn't the borrower the one writing it? Uva ma'as lefnei chachamim, so it was brought up to the chacham, let's say the Sanhedrin, to decide, is this an appropriate way to draft contracts? V'hitiru, and they said, yeah, it's fine, no problem. Lefi, so why? Because it's the signatories which are making the contract, not the handwriting that in which it was written. So, says the Mishnah further, Lefi darkecha atalamed, so from that approach you can infer the following extra halachas, if you will, Sha'isha koseves es gita, that a woman can write her own get. Okay, there are actually a number of halachas that govern the writing of gittin. For starters, it has to be owned by the husband. It has to be written either by his own hand or at his explicit instruction. So the case would have to be where essentially the husband owns a piece of paper in which this get is written, one way or the other, and he actually explicitly instructs his wife to write the get. But the point is, if she is like the scribe who writes it, and then after she writes it, she gives the get to him, and then he gives that written get back to her because she has received it in her hand, that would, yes, be effective. That sounds counterintuitive because, like, she's writing the get, but the point is, it's fine. We don't care who wrote it. The get is just the tool by which he's divorced his wife. So if it's an effective get, it doesn't matter that she wrote it. Va'ish kosev es shovaro. Same goes. A man can write his own receipt. So the idea here is that if a person divorced his wife, he has to pay her ksuba, let's call that 200 zuz. She's supposed to get the 200 zuz and at the same time give him back the ksuba, which he would tear up so she can't collect a second time. If she claims she doesn't have the ksuba, so the procedure would be that he gets a receipt, a shovar, which says he paid the 200 zuz. So that way, if she takes him to court in the future, when she finds her ksuba or to a different bezdin, he'll say, yeah, but I paid this already and here's the proof. I have a shovar, I have a receipt. So the point is, who would you think should write the receipt? You would think she should write it because that proves that she agrees that it was given. But the point is, it doesn't matter. Even he could write the shovar himself in his own handwriting because what makes the receipt effective, if you will, is that it has witnesses that certify it. She'ein kiyum haget ela b'chosmav, says the Mishnah, because the kiyum, the efficacy, the certification of a get, now the word get in this context here means any old contract. Get has come to mean specifically like the sefer krisus, the divorce, bill of divorce that a man gives to his wife. But the truth is that a get can mean any contract, as it does in this context over here. Ela b'chosmav, what makes it effective is simply the fact that it has acceptable witnesses who certify that the get is what it says it is. That's the first part of the Mishnah. Now the second part of the Mishnah, which is the last of the four things that this Chanina Skana Kohanim testified about, has to do with Tumah and Tahara. Let me explain this outside as well first. The issue is, what happens if you have a korban in the base of Mikdash, and the kohanim essentially are you know, processing it, basically they flay and butcher the meat, and let's say it's a, for argument's sake, let's say it's an ola, it's all going to be burned. Okay? And while they're processing the korban, they find stuck into its flesh a needle they recognize was a needle which is tameh, the specific case of our Mishnah, according to the Rambam anyways, is actually a needle that was inside a corpse, and it's Tamei Mace. So that'd be the most potent source of Tumah, because in fact, as I said kind of just not long ago, that if you have metal that touches a corpse, like a needle inside a corpse, the needle itself would be an avi avos, like the corpse itself. So the most potent source of Tumah that there is, meaning it would actually make a person who touches it an ava Tumah. Okay, so now we discover this very potent source of Tumah in the flesh of the carcass of the korban. So the question is, what now? So there's the question of, what is the korban Tameh? Of course, the answer is yes, presumably because it's got a source of Tumah right into the flesh. A little more on that in a moment. But what's with the knife that the Kohen used to slaughter the animal? What's the Kohen himself? So the basic gist of our Mishnah is that this is a case of a suffix. We don't know what touched the needle, and therefore the parts we don't know about, so we'll rule based on the general rule which governs all sfeikas regarding Tumah, which is that suffix Tumah b'rishus harabim, if a question regarding whether Tumah spread in a public place, rishus harabim in this context doesn't mean like the Shabbos rishus harabim that has no walls and traffic. It means simply that there's at least three people there regularly. It's a public place. It's learned from the halachas of the Sota. It's not a private place. And so a suffix Tumah b'rishus harabim is tahor, and a suffix Tumah b'rishus hayachid, if in a private place, again, b'rishus hayachid doesn't mean it has to have like the four machitzas like for Hilchos Shabbos, it just simply means a place where there aren't people frequenting all the time. So b'rishus hayachid, so then sfeiko tameh. We rule it to be definitively tameh. And the point is that in the Azara, the Beis HaMikdash courtyard, people are there regularly, and therefore it's considered b'rishus harabim, and even though it has walls around it. And therefore, if we don't know if there was a conveyance of Tumah, which is the case here, we don't know for certainty whether or not the person, the Kohen, or his knife touched that needle. So therefore, we'll rule it all to be Tahor. Okay? That is the basic gist of the first part of the Mishnah. Let me read the Mishnah inside, then I'll sort of bring in a few more details here. It says, Va'al machat shenimtzes babasar, if you find a needle which you recognize as being a source of Tumah, and it's in the flesh of the carcass of the animal that was brought as a korban, shasakin v'yadayim tahoros, both the knife and the hands of the Kohen are all tahor, v'abasar tamei, and the meat is tamei. Let's just go through these things one at a time. The knife will be tahor because we don't know the knife touched the needle, and therefore it's a suffik, and sveiko tumah, suffik tumah b'rishus ha-rabim, sveiko tahor, so the rules, knife will be considered to be tahor, no problem. Now, v'yadayim tahoros, the hands are tahor. This is actually, there's a lot more here than meets the eye. In general, the question should be, is the Kohen tamei or not? The answer is the Kohen touched the meat, but it didn't touch the needle, as far as we know, and therefore rule will be tahor. Now, that is important to just understand that we know for certain that the meat itself is tamei, the Mishnah says it. But since the recipients of Tumah can come in one of four categories, Adam, a person, Kalim, a utensil, the Adam here would be the Kohen, the Kalim would be, for example, the knife, Ochlin, food, like the meat of this korban, and Mashkin, drinks, liquids, okay? Now, the most Tameh that a food, Ochlin, could be is a Rishon L'Tumah. It can never be an Ava Tumah. That's a rule. So even if the needle was an Avi Avos, and it's sitting inside the meat here, the carcass, so at most the carcass could be is a Rishon. It can never be an Av. So if it's a Rishon, there's a separate rule, which is that a person or a Kli can't become Tameh from a source that isn't an avatoma. And since food can never be an avatoma, a person can never become Tameh from food. So therefore, if the knife or the person touched the meat but didn't touch the needle, of course they're Tahor. So the question is if it touched the needle, and we don't know, so we're going to rule because of a suffix Tahor. Now, the Mishnah here doesn't say that the Kohen is Tahor, but rather his Yadayim, his hands are Tahor. And that is because there's a separate din, a din derabanan, which says that even though things that are Rishon L'Tumah can't make a person Tameh, they could make a person's hands Tameh. That's a separate din, that Yadayim, hands that touch a Rishon L'Tumah become Shneem, they become Sheni L'Tumah, just the hands, not the whole person, but just the guy's hands. That's a din derabanan. And while that is true, that din derabanan doesn't apply in the Beis HaMikdash. Chazal never goes to that din derabanan because that would make for like ongoing Tumah problems in the Beis HaMikdash, which we don't want. And therefore, the point of the Mishnah here is, even though the hands of the Kohen certainly touched the meat, and the meat is certainly a Rishon, his hands remain Tahor because that's a din also itself, the Din Darabanan doesn't apply for hands becoming a sheni in the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, and the basar is tamei, as we said before, the meat is tamei, because certainly it became tamei. Now there's a question there, which is, for any ochlin foodstuff to become tamei, it needs to have hechsher, it has to be pre-wetted by one of these seven liquids, known by the mnemonic Yad Shachat Dam. I'm not going to that now, but the point is, if this was a living animal, now it's just been slaughtered, so where did the liquid come from to be machshirt? And the truth is, even though there could have been blood that splashed on it, but the blood from Karbonos actually isn't machshir anyways. So the question is, how could it happen? So the Gemara ends up saying, Bartunur brings it, essentially this animal was like dripping wet from when it came from into the basement, so it came, you know, dripping wet from going through some water, and it's still wet, so that how the water was machshir, it made the meat ready to become tummy. That's not essential to understand the Mishnah, but it answers the question of how did meat become tameh when it needs hechsher, needs to be wetted first. Okay. The latter part of the Mishnah here says, Vim nimtzes beperish. If you find the needle in the waist of the animal, hakol tahor, everything is tahor. Now this means, even if, where do you find this needle? Inside the intestines of the animal that you have to clean out. You can't do an ola without first cleaning out the intestines so you don't burn the waste material on the altar, the Mizbeach. So if you're cleaning out the intestines and there you see inside the intestines, there's that needle that was stuck in the mace, it doesn't matter and everything is tahor. Why? Because the waste material inside the intestines of the animal is not an adam or a kli or ochlin or mashkin. It's not food or drink. Even if the animal had diarrhea, let's say, and it was all liquidy, that's not considered to be mashke. It's just disgusting liquid. So the point is, it's not tumas susceptible, the waste inside the intestines. And that being the case, even though it was inside the animal, and the animal, even if let's say the animal itself was physically susceptible to tumah, there's no direct contact between animal and the tumah source, and therefore even the flesh of the animal, the korban, stays tahor.